Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
We've got quite a pile of material in front of us today. Things like royal inscriptions, some cuneiform tablets, archaeological reports, scholarly analyses.
A real mix.
Yeah.
And all focused on one thing. The ancient Assyrians, their presence, their influence, the remnants they left specifically in and around the Afrin region, northwestern Syria.
Exactly. And our job really is to sift through all this, pull out the key insights, and try to build a picture of what that area was like during the Assyrian period.
And it's such an important area historically.
Always has been, hasn't it? It sits right at this kind of crossroads. You've got Anatolia north, Mesopotamia east, the Levant south.
Plus fertile land, the river, key routes.
Which, of course, made it a prime target for empires. Like the Assyrians, they definitely saw the value there.
Absolutely. Strategic value, economic value. It was always going to attract attention.
So maybe let's start with the basics. The geography, the names. What are we actually looking at on the map? And what did people, especially the Assyrians, call this place?
Okay. Well, geographically, the heart of it is the Afrin River Valley. Then you have the mountains around it, like the Kurd Mountains to the west. The river is really the defining feature.
And the river's name itself has a history.
Oh, definitely. Our sources, the Assyrian text, they call it Apri, or maybe Apri. There's this really interesting mention pretty early, 876 BC.
876 BC. That's quite specific.
It is. It mentions the Apri Neri, the Apri River, irrigating the Petnovasia, the plain of Patina, or Unki. That's the big plain just south of Afrin.
So hang on. Even back in the early 9th century BC, the Assyrians knew this specific river and knew it fed the neighboring kingdom's farmland.
Seems so. It shows they had, you know, pretty good geographical intelligence early on, even before they properly moved in.
That's a key point right there. Early awareness.
And later scholars, people like Breasted, they looked at these texts and confirmed, yeah, Apri is the Afrin. The name kept changing, though. Oidoparas in the Seleucid Greek era, Euphrenus under the Romans, Nor Ephrin in medieval Arabic sources.
It's like layers of history just in the name. What about the modern name, Afrin? Any ideas there?
Well, some theories connect it to Kurdish words. Things meaning maybe flowing water or creation, giving life. Makes sense for a river valley, right?
It does.
And the wider region had other ancient names too. Chelebonitis, Serestica, later as part of Roman provinces. But geographically, the key is the Afrin River flows south, joins the Orontes system down into that Amuk plain near Antakya, part of that big ancient network.
Okay, so established geography, established importance. Let's rewind a bit further. What about the earlier Assyrian periods? Old Assyrian, Middle Assyrian. Do our sources show them active in the Afrin Valley then?
Well, looking through this material, direct solid evidence in the valley itself for the old Assyrian, say 2000 to 1750 BC, or even the Middle Assyrian, like 1365 to 934 BC. It's not really prominent.
The old Assyrians had those big trade networks, right, up into Anatolia.
They did, those famous Karum routes. But the sources we have don't really suggest their political control reached this far west into Syria then. Middle Assyrian times, yeah, you see westward expansion. Kings like Ashur-uballit I, Adad-nirari I, Tukulti-Ninurta the first, they pushed towards the Euphrates, clashed with the Hittites.
Any settlements?
There's evidence of a small Middle Assyrian site further east, Tel Tuera, ancient Harb. But that's distinct from Afrin.
And the Dunnu system, those fortified farms they set up sometimes.
That's a good point. The Dunnu system, these state-run agricultural estates, sometimes with resettled people, it was definitely a tool they used. We see it clearly at places like Tel Sabi Abyad over in the Balik Valley. But importantly, the sources we're looking at for this study, they don't point to similar Dunnu estates being set up in the Afrin Valley proper during the Middle Assyrian period.
So the takeaway is maybe some indirect influence, maybe scouting, but no clear evidence from these sources of them actually settling or administering the Afrin Valley itself back then.
That seems to be the picture from this material, yes. Either it was less direct, or the specific archaeological proof just hasn't surfaced yet for this particular valley. Unlike other regions, no strong sign of direct Middle Assyrian control here.
Okay, so it sounds like the major change, the really transformative period, comes later with the Neo-Assyrians.
Absolutely. The Neo-Assyrian period, starting around 911 BC, is a completely different story. Their whole approach shifted. It wasn't just about influence or tribute anymore. It was about conquest and direct annexation. Aggressive expansion.
Let's focus on that early phase, the 9th century BC. We've got kings like Ashurnasirpal II making waves.
Pretty huge waves.
Yeah.
Ashurnasirpal II, ruling 883-859 BC, was relentless. His campaigns took him right to the Mediterranean. He came into direct contact with all those Syro-Hittite and Aramean kingdoms in northern Syria, including Pitina, or Unki, in that plain just south of Afrin.
And his famous banquet stele, that huge inscription celebrating his palace, it mentions Pitina.
It does, yeah. Dates to about 879 BC, one of the first Neo-Syrian mentions. And his own annals say that around 870 BC, he received tribute from Lubarna, the king of Pitina, at Kunulua, which we think is Tel Tenat.
So that, plus the earlier mention of the Apura watering Pitina's fields.
Exactly. It builds a picture. They knew the area, knew the players. Even early on, they were already asserting dominance, demanding tribute.
And this continues with his son, Shalmaneser III.
Oh, yes. Shalmaneser III, 859-824 BC, kept the pressure on. He was constantly campaigning out west, often fighting coalitions of these Syrian states. Pitina pops up again. Figures like Sapalumi the Pitinian are mentioned fighting him.
Isn't there a depiction of a king from Pitina on Shalmaneser's throne?
There is, on his throne base from Fort Shalmaneser. Kalpurunda Pitina is shown bringing tribute, a very visible symbol of submission.
Shalmaneser also had a big impact just east of Afrin on the kingdom of Bit-Agusi.
Right. Bit-Agusi stretched south from around Azaz. Shalmaneser sacked their capital, Arne or probably Telerin, in 849 BC. The sources suggest this might be why Bit-Agusi then shifted its capital south to Arpad, modern Tel Rifat, a really important site later on.
So the 9th century is all about increasing Assyrian military presence, pressure, extracting tribute. But the local kingdoms are still there, resisting or submitting.
Exactly. They haven't been swallowed up yet. And what's really fascinating, the sources also show us that the local culture wasn't just vanishing under this pressure.
You mean like that stele?
Precisely.
Mm.
That Luwian stele found near Afrin city, it's basalt, shows the storm god Tashub, and crucially, it has a hieroglyphic Luwian inscription, dated maybe 9th, maybe 8th century BC.
So, not Assyrian.
Definitely not. It's purely local Neo-Hittite tradition. Right there, in the period when Assyrian power is growing, it's a fantastic piece of evidence showing that these local identities and traditions were still very much alive. The Assyrians were moving into a culturally rich and complex area, not a vacuum.
That stele really brings that point home. Okay, so pressure builds in the 9th century, then comes the 8th century BC. And Tiglath-Pileser III, this seems to be the real turning point.
It absolutely is. Tiglath-Pileser III, 744-727 BC, fundamentally changed Assyrian imperial policy. He wasn't just interested in tribute. He wanted systematic, permanent annexation and provincialization. He was an empire builder.
And Arpad, that new capital of Bit-Agusi you mentioned, Tel Rifat, it becomes a major target.
A primary target. Arpad, sitting there just west of the main Afrin Valley, was powerful, strategically located. And crucially, it had allied itself with Urartu, Assyria's big rival up in the north.
Bad move.
Very bad move. Tiglath-Pileser first dealt with Urartu, defeated them near Arpad in 743 BC. Then he turned on Arpad itself. The siege lasted 3 years.
3 years. That tells you how strong it was, how important they considered it.
It finally fell in 740 BC. And the key thing is, it wasn't just looted. It was systematically turned into an Assyrian provincial capital. The kingdom of Bit-Agusi was wiped off the map. This was permanent occupation and administration.
And what about Patna-Ankh, down in the Amuk Plain, watered by the Apre River?
Same treatment. Tiglath-Pileser conquered their capital, Kenalia, or Kunulua Tel Tainat, in 738 BC, accused the king of disloyalty. The kingdom was dissolved, became an Assyrian province named Kunalia or Kenalia, based right there at Tainat. And the sources specifically mentioned deportations from Kenalia. Standard Syrian practice.
Okay, so Arpad province established 740 BC, Kunalia province established 738 BC. What about the Eindara temple, that major local religious site right in the Afrin district? How does it fit in?
The timing is striking. The Eindara temple, this amazing Syro-Hittite structure near Eindara village. Its main period of use seems to end right around 740 BC. Scholarly sources state pretty clearly it was overrun in the 8th century BC by the Assyrians. And then basically abandoned.
740 BC, the same year Arpad falls. That can't be a coincidence.
It really doesn't feel like it. Arpad falls 740. Eindara abandoned around 740. Kunulua Tainat falls 738. It looks very much like a coordinated strategy by Tiglath-Pileser III.
To do what? Take out the political centers and the major religious centers.
It certainly seems plausible. Dismantle the political power at Arpad and Kunulua, and maybe neutralize a major ancient religious center like Eindara that was deeply tied to local identity and potentially resistance. Remember, Eindara was purely Syro-Hittite in its main phases, incredible architecture. Those giant footprints, probably dedicated to Ishtar or Astarte, maybe Hadad, a real symbol of the pre-Assyrian culture. Destroying or desecrating such a site sends a powerful message.
So Tiglath-Pileser wasn't just grabbing land, he was restructuring the whole region's power, politics, maybe even its spiritual focus.
That seems to be the implication. And his successor, Sargon II, 721-705 BC, he just continued these policies. Interestingly, Arpad actually joined a revolt against Sargon in 720 BC.
Really? Even after being made a province?
Shows the resistance lingered, but Sargon crushed it, reinforcing that Assyrian control was absolute.
So once these areas are provinces, how did the Assyrians actually run them day to day? What does the archaeology show us about their administration on the ground?
Well, they installed their own officials. The head guy in a province was usually the governor, the Bulpahidi. And the sources show this wasn't just nominal oversight. It was a proper embedded system.
And that tablet from Tel Tainat is key here, right? The Esarhaddon one.
Oh, the Esarhaddon oath tablet is fantastic evidence. Found at Tainat, the capital of Kunalia province, dated around 672 BC. It's this loyalty oath sworn to King Esarhaddon's chosen successor, Ashurbanipal. And it wasn't just sworn by the Assyrian governor.
Who else?
Loads of local figures, local officials, village leaders, important people within the province, they were all bound by oath to support the Assyrian succession. It shows just how deeply integrated these provinces were into the core politics of the empire. Even mentions officials like village inspectors, the Rabilani. Control went way down.
Wow. So they co-opted or compelled the local leadership structure right into their system. And the physical archaeology at sites like Tainat backs this up.
Absolutely. Tel Tainat gives us probably the best picture for this specific region. Excavations found what they call the governor's residence, building knights. It uses Assyrian architectural styles. It's like they were building mini palaces out in the provinces.
Replicating the structures of power.
Exactly. And the temple complex there, buildings the second and XE6, it looks like it was converted into an Assyrian religious center, maybe a double temple design, which you see in Assyria. They found Assyrian-style cultic items. A big Assyrian glazed ware jar.
And the tablets weren't just the oath tablet.
No, they found other cuneiform texts too. Administrative fragments, but also things like hemerologies. Those are like calendars of lucky and unlucky days. And lexical lists, sort of like ancient dictionaries. Finding these specific kinds of texts used in administration and state religion back in Assyria, here in the provincial temple.
Shows they brought the whole system with them. Scribes, rituals, administrative methods.
Precisely. Plus, lots of Assyrian pottery, glazed ware, palace ware, seals, metal objects. Tainat really demonstrates a functioning Assyrian imperial center, projecting power into the surrounding area, which definitely included the Afrin Valley nearby.
Okay, what about Arpad? Tel Rifat, the other provincial capital.
Right. Tel Rifat is identified as Arpad, became a provincial capital after 740 BC. It has massive defensive walls still visible from that time. Now, the sources we have don't detail its administrative buildings quite like Tainat's, but as a provincial capital, you have to assume similar structures. Governor's residence, administrative offices were there, controlling the territory, including the western parts of the Afrin area.
Makes sense. And Tel Jindaris, that one's actually in the Afrin Valley.
Yes. Jindaris is a major site right in the valley.
Yeah.
Archaeology shows occupation through the Iron Age, 3, so 9th down to 6th centuries BC, covering the whole Neo-Assyrian period. The finds mentioned in these sources are mainly domestic buildings, houses.
So not the big administrative stuff like at Tainat.
Not described in the same way in this material, no. But its location puts it squarely within the zone controlled by Arpad and Kunalia. It shows us everyday life continuing within the provincial system, even if the main Assyrian administrative infrastructure was centered in the nearby capital.
So Jindaris is like the local town living under the administration based just down the road?
Pretty much. But we have to remember that Afrin still again.
The Tushib one with the Luwian writing.
Found near Afrin city, 9th, 8th century BC. It sits alongside all this evidence of Assyrian control. It's that vital reminder of the local Neo-Hittite identity persisting right through this period of Assyrian dominance. A real counterpoint.
What about Siris, Nadihuri? That's on the river too.
Siris becomes really important later, yes. But it was mainly founded in the Seleucid period, after the Assyrians. Our sources here don't really talk about significant Assyrian-era occupation at Siris itself. Any influence would have been part of the general regional control.
And the mountains, the Kurd Da.
Definitely part of the sphere of influence. Controlling mountain areas was always important for security, for resources like timber, maybe manpower. Assyrian texts often mention getting tribute or submission from groups in hilly regions next to their main provinces. That likely applied here, too.
Ooh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Ridgebosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Always welcome.
Let me see. How is it today?
Smells wonderful. Fragrant.
Yeah, it's actually it's really good today. Nicely balanced. Doesn't seem bitter at all.
Agreed. No extra sugar needed for me. Just right.
Perfect. Let's just take a moment then.
Okay.
All right. Back to it. So we've seen how the Assyrians took control, set up their administration, the evidence on the ground. What was the overall impact of all this on the region? Long term, short term?
Well, the impact was massive on multiple levels.
Yeah.
Politically, administratively. It was total transformation. As we said, local kingdoms like Bitigusi and Patina were gone, replaced by direct Assyrian provincial rule.
Mm.
Governors, oaths binding local elites,
mm-hmm.
deep integration.
And the economy.
Yeah.
Clearly a huge factor.
Oh, absolutely central. Controlling this area gave them control over those vital trade routes. Mesopotamia, Anatolia, the Med Coast. It was about systematic extraction. Tribute, taxes, funneling the agricultural wealth from the valleys, timber from the hills, maybe metals, back to the Assyrian heartland.
And the deportations you mentioned from Canalia, that's economic too, in a grim way. Labor.
Exactly. Deportations were a tool. Break resistance, yes, but also provide skilled and unskilled labor for the empire's building projects or army. It would have definitely changed the local population mix, the culture. A major disruption.
Which brings us to culture. Was it just Assyrian culture wiping out everything else? You mentioned the steel, suggesting otherwise.
Yeah, it's definitely more complicated than that. There was certainly a process you could call Assyrianization. We see it in the architecture at Tainat, the governor's palace, the temple changes. They brought their styles.
Religion, too.
Seems likely. Converting the Tainat temple suggests introducing Assyrian state gods or rituals.
Mm.
And administration was definitely Assyrian. The language was Akkadian, used on those cuneiform tablets. Local scribes would have had to learn it, or Assyrian scribes were brought in.
But the local stuff didn't just vanish.
No, that Luwian steel is the perfect example. Local Neo-Hittite identity, language, religion clearly persisted.
Yeah.
So the picture that emerges isn't one of replacement, but more of a hybrid situation,
yeah.
An overlay. Assyrian imperial culture was imposed on top of and interacted with these enduring local traditions.
So a complex mix. Assyrian administration, Assyrian officials, Assyrian language for business, maybe some Assyrian gods. But underneath or alongside, local people speaking their languages, worshiping their gods, maintaining traditions.
That's likely much closer to the reality, yes. A mm-hmm. dynamic interaction, not just a simple takeover.
Okay. Now, this mighty Neo-Assyrian empire, it doesn't last forever. It collapses pretty spectacularly in the late 7th century BC. What happens in places like Afrin, then?
Right. The empire buckled under internal problems and external attacks. Babylonians, Medes, Nineveh, the capital, falls in 612 BC. The last Assyrian resistance is crushed around 609 BC near Haran.
So who picks up the pieces in northwestern Syria?
First, it's the Neo-Babylonians. They were key players in Assyria's downfall and essentially inherited much of its western territory, including this region. They often kept the existing Assyrian provincial structures in place initially.
And then?
Then came the Persians. Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon in 539 BC, and the whole region became part of the vast Achaemenid Persian Empire.
And those provincial centers the Assyrians set up, like Arpad and Cornelia Tainat, still important?
Almost certainly. Their strategic location and the administrative infrastructure built by the Assyrians made them valuable. New empires don't usually just abandon useful provincial capitals. They likely continued to function just under new management Babylonian governors, then Persian satraps.
So the Assyrian legacy in terms of administration, maybe even roads, kind of lived on.
To an extent, yes. Successor empires often adopted or adapted the systems that worked. And culturally, one lasting impact was the Aramaic language.
How so?
Aramaic speakers were widespread in Syria and Mesopotamia, and the Assyrians actually facilitated its use, partly through deportations and integration.
Hmm.
It became a common language, lingua franca, across the empire. And that continued, even intensified under the Babylonians and Persians. It became the dominant everyday language here for centuries.
Okay. Now, one really important distinction we need to make based on everything we've discussed about this ancient period. We're talking about the Assyrian Empire, a political entity from millennia ago. This is different from modern Assyrian communities, isn't it?
Yes, that's a absolutely crucial point to be clear about. Modern Assyrians, who might also identify as Syriacs or Chaldeans, are an indigenous Christian people of the Middle East. Their history continues long after the ancient empire, obviously. And importantly, their main historical population centers and communities within Syria are predominantly in the northeast.
In the Jazeera region. along the Kabur River.
Exactly. Places like Komashli, Hasake, the Kabur villages, that's the heartland of the modern Assyrian presence in Syria.
So while Assyrian individuals might live anywhere today, including Afrin, the Afrin region itself isn't considered a traditional center of modern Assyrian settlement in the way northeastern Syria is.
That's correct. The ancient imperial presence, we've spent this time discussing the governors, the garrisons, the provincial administration in the Afrin area, that's a specific historical chapter tied to the ancient empire. The history, demography, and major communities of modern Assyrians in Syria are centered elsewhere. It's vital not to confuse the ancient empire's reach with the geography of the modern people.
Understood. A very important clarification. Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. Looking back over all this material.
It paints a pretty clear picture, doesn't it? From that early Assyrian awareness and probing in the 9th century BC.
To that decisive shift under Tiglath-Pileser III in the 8th century. Annexation, provincialization.
Taking over Arpad, taking over Cunalia Tainat, the likely impact on Ayandara. Setting up this whole administrative machine.
It really transformed the region politically, economically, culturally. But as we saw with the steel, it was always an interaction, a layering of the imperial onto the local.
Absolutely. And elements of that Assyrian administrative framework and the cultural mix it created had echoes long after the empire itself was gone.
It really makes you think. So maybe a final thought for you listening. When we uncover these deep layers of history, like the Assyrian story in a place like Afrin, how does that change how we see that place today? What does understanding this specific ancient past, the rise and fall of empires, the persistence of local culture, tell us about why certain places remain important and about the incredibly complex interwoven history of the people who have lived there over thousands of years?
It definitely shows how the past is never really that far away. It's embedded in the landscape itself.
Thank you so much for walking us through these sources today. A fascinating look at the Assyrian chapter in the long history of the Afrin region. We hope you found it insightful. Standard show outro.